listening to Truth to You with Jono, and g'day to Marlon in Shillong, Meghalaya, India. I hope I've pronounced that correctly, in India. And thank you for listening. Wherever you may be around the world, it's good to have your company. It is time for Light of the Prophets with Yoel Ben Shlomo. G'day, Yoel.
G'day to you too.
Hey, you know, we're going to be jumping a few chapters, aren't we?
Yeah, we have to, unless you want a geography lesson here. We can't really do...
Don't want a geography
lesson.
We can't
really do these chapters.
No, today we're going to be jumping ahead to Joshua chapter 19. We're going to be picking up from verse 49 because you, the listener, have done your homework and you've read the previous chapters and you've looked at the corresponding map in your study Bible and you've figured it all out. And if you haven't done that, you can press pause now and we'll still be here when you get back.
Exactly.
Okay.
So, but just before we start, I mean, we're dealing with the book of Joshua.
Yes.
And we're dealing about conquering the land, owning the land. And there's actually something that obviously a lot of people who listen to this program and other programs as well on Truth to You are probably very aware of, is the argument of who actually owns the land. The past couple of years, unfortunately, the Arabs have found a very, very simple but very efficient way of influencing the way people think. Mm-hmm. And I personally think this is endangering the free world in general, because if you know what Islam is, you know it does not give you freedom. Mm-hmm. And what's been going on lately is, for example, to delegitimize the fact that the state of Israel even exists, so they're eating through our rights from place to place. And for example, lately there was this woman who lives in Canada, but she claims her family comes from Tiberias. And she says, I have the right to live in Tiberias, and this is where she's joined a bunch of anarchists here in Israel to cause a lot of trouble. There's a few pieces of information. For example, Tiberias was actually a Jewish city. Also, Jenin was a Jewish city. Gaza was a Jewish city for a very, very long time. So I don't know what they're talking about when it comes to this whole thing of them living here and their families being here. Mm. Most of them are from Lebanon, Iraq, and Egypt. They came here. They know where their families came from. It's basically a war against the fact that there's someone else living in this area who's not a Muslim. But what's been going on lately as well is the level of influence, for example, in campuses and universities. So the new thing that's going on now is marking produce that come from Judea and Samaria. I have to understand something. Israel is a very, very productive country. Unlike what people try to describe it, Israel is extremely productive to a level, for example, the Jordanians would not have agriculture if it wasn't for us. We actually taught the Jordanians in the Jordan Valley how to develop the agriculture there. We taught many countries how to do a lot of things that they didn't, because we have the experience and we have the technology. Mm-hmm. So this whole thing of boycotting Israel or boycotting produce from Judea and Samaria. In South Africa, for example, now they're doing that. So if you're in South Africa and you hear this, if you want to stand beside Israel, you have to go into the shop and say, you deliberately buy produce from Judea and Samaria. Look for the markings and deliberately buy them. Mm. Because if you truly stand next to Israel, you wouldn't be afraid to say anything to anyone. And it's really starting to get to me lately because, for example, I used to live in Samaria for a while, and I know from the inside what goes on with the Arabs. And most of the Arabs, we know as a fact, are relatively new here, and they're also multiplying at a massive rate. So they can claim, oh, but we've been here for centuries, and most of them haven't. For example, Nablus was a tiny little village for a very, very long while, mm-hmm. until it became popular, and they received money from the EU. You know, EU, for example, I spoke with someone from the Netherlands, and he told me that Europeans don't really care anymore what's going on in this area. They really, really don't care anymore. But the EU has to stuff its nose into everything. Mm-hmm. So one of the things that happened a couple of days ago was that in Samaria, the Arabs start fires deliberately on the Sabbath. And then they come with video cameras. They want to film what goes on. Now, the thing is that people don't know what the rules of engagement are. And the rules of engagement in Judea and Samaria are very, very simple. If you're in danger, you can open fire. When this video was published on YouTube, no one tells them what really went on. It's always filmed from one end. No one knows what happens. And surprisingly enough, this time the military is actually standing on the side of the people from the little towns, saying, no, we actually were there. We know what was going on. And but there are organizations going and demeaning. By doing this, they're only demeaning the settlers, but they don't understand. They're actually demeaning the entire state of Israel. Mm-hmm. And these people are enemies of the Jewish people, even though they come from the Jewish world, these people are enemies. And this is why it's also very important, if you're donating money to organizations, to check who the organization is affiliated with. Because you might be funneling money into organizations who are damaging the rights of the people of Israel to live on its land. Mm-hmm. Before 1948, the Arabs were fighting against us already. They declared back in the 1920s a 100-year war. Okay, so it's a game, and it's a very dangerous one. And it surprises me how the Western world can be so childish when it comes to this subject. The Western world being so enlightened world, which gave us Nazism and fascism, you know, it's literally childish mindset. You speak with people from these organizations, they don't think beyond their, actually, literally no, don't think beyond their noses. But it's a very, very dangerous game, endangering a lot of people, not necessarily the state of Israel, endangering everyone around the world, because the Arabs are slowly taking over the Western world. And if you want to live as free people, you have to go out there. And it's not necessarily has to do with standing next to Israel, but by standing next to Israel, you're also standing against them. And sure. And it is dangerous what's going on at the moment in the world. And because they come from a Mediterranean Eastern world and a mindset, Westerners don't understand what's going on. And they could be smiley and everything and be your best friends in the world. Trust me, these people endanger the Western world, endanger every country they infiltrate into. So I had to say this because lately it's really starting to bug me.
Sure, sure. And I mean, it's relevant, right? Because we're talking about the land of Israel. We're talking about these previous chapters are the chapters where it's divided up and it's given to the 12 tribes. Yet today the enemies of Israel are all around it and wanting to wipe it off the map. And you can't be a friend of Israel and be friends with its enemies at the same time. It just doesn't work.
Exactly. And by the way, for example, USA might stand one day for United States of Arabia. And I'm not saying this is a joke, but that's what Islam teaches. Mm-hmm. And Islam is not a religion of peace. They will stand up in your own countries, no matter where you are, and they will say their ancestors were always there. Okay? This is why, for example, they have to insist that, for example, Yeshua was a Muslim. You know, I've heard this from them. They say everyone was a Muslim. Mm. It kind of teaches you what really goes through their heads.
It blows one's mind, really, because when you look at the history of Islam, of course, you see where, at least as far as Muhammad is concerned, where it began, what year it began, and there's a lot of revisionism going on, and it's very, very difficult to take anything seriously when they cannot see past that fact. But, I mean,
exactly.
You know, we're banging our heads against the brick wall. We better get into it. What do you reckon?
Yeah, I think we should get into it. But remember, the warning is out there, and it doesn't take too much to change things.
Amen.
All you have to do is start basically realizing who your real enemy is.
And the enemy
is not always a clear one. So, it's very easy to demean the minority in the world, which is, by the way, the Jews. We are one of the smallest nations around the world. But we represent one thing that contradicts everything Islam tries to teach. Islam believes in replacement theology, and we're not gone. We've never vanished.
Amen.
And it drives them mad.
And they hate that. And so make a conscious effort, dear listeners, and buy Israel. You know, purchase products from Israel. And if you know the enemies, if you've done your research and you know the enemies of Israel, don't purchase those products. Boycott those products. Yeah.
Exactly. Simple. Calling to boycott Israel, basically boycott Islam. Seriously. I'm not saying this is a joke.
Buy Israel, boycott Islam.
Exactly.
There it is in a nutshell.
And now there'll be a bounty in my head, there'll be a fatwa in my head or something. That's all how right. They deal with things. We don't like him. Let's kill him. That's basically how they deal with things.
I don't know that there's a lot of Muslims that listen to truth to you.
I don't think there are, but I won't be surprised if it might leak out somewhere. But the fact remains that, yes, you know what you are. You can't lie to us.
Mm-hmm. Amen. Here it begins in verse 49.
So here it begins.
This is now Joshua's inheritance, right? When they had made an end of dividing the land as an inheritance, according to their borders, and the children of Israel gave an inheritance among them to Joshua, the son of Nun, Yehoshua bin Nun, right? Bin Nun. According to the word Jehovah gave him, the city which he asked for. Now, what city was that?
Timnath Chares. Okay. As far as I remember.
In the mountains of Ephraim.
To tell the truth, I'm not even too sure where you're reading. Where are you reading? I mean, you kind of like go into something and... Yeah, it's called Timnath Serach. Yeah, I just noticed where you're reading.
Okay, so I'm in chapter 19.
You say verse 49, so it's chapter 19, verse 49.
That's where we are. And he dwelt there. He built a city there, and he dwelt in it, right? Okay.
Yeah, so there's actually a place called Kefil Haris or something like that.
Mm-hmm.
So they say maybe there's like some kind of perversion of the original name. It's kind of interesting. The Arabs never – most of the names of the places here in Israel, the Arabs never invented this. These are ancient names which they preserved in an Arabic dialect.
Mm. And so verse 51, these were the inheritances which Eleazar, the priest – it's Aaron's son, right? Yehoshua bin Nun – and the heads of the fathers of the tribes of the children of Israel divided as an inheritance by lot. Now there was a lot of that, right? There's a lot of dividing by lot, and we're going to read a little bit more about that. Do you want to talk about that now?
Well, if we're going to be skipping to chapter 20, we're going to be basically ignoring the whole concept of the lot. So I think that it's kind of important to explain exactly how it was done. First of all, something kind of interesting that I noticed last week, because I was thinking that we're going to be doing this subject last week and realized it was moved to this week, it was basically my mistake. I was like, okay, we're doing this, and then reading a whole bunch of stuff. And then last week he told me, oh, we're doing this. I'm like, oh, no, I read something else. but one of the things that they pointed out there was the practice of how they divided inheritance amongst children.
Mm-hmm.
And it's kind of interesting. First of all, what we see is that certain tribes didn't go through a lot. They actually, if we look at the beginning, certain tribes were just given pieces of land.
Okay. Oh,
Joseph, the tribes of the children of Joseph received certain types of land, and Judah received pieces of land.
Mm-hmm.
And then they actually, for the other seven tribes, they actually cast a lot, which is kind of interesting, because in the ancient world, what they used to do is that when they divide up the land from the inheritance from the father, and it's kind of interesting, you start dividing up the land, in the end someone's left with like a tiny little patch of grass or something.
Sure.
And I think that I think I know how they solved it, but what they did was that the firstborn would just receive his inheritance.
Mm-hmm.
He just received like 50% of the inheritance, and that was it.
Sure.
He just got, that's his, and there's no lots with him. And then the rest of the brothers, because the sisters usually married off, so they went to live in the inheritance of the husband.
Mm-hmm.
But the other children, they used to cast lots in between them, who was going to get what. Now, for example, you go to the Valley of Dotan in Samaria, and it's a very, very fertile piece of land there. And you can divide that area up into several sections based on creeks and walls and rocks and natural things that happen. And that's how they divide up lots.
Natural boundaries.
Exactly.
Sure.
Exactly. Natural boundaries, which they decide, okay, this is going to be the boundary between us. Now, by the way, you should know that there is a curse, and it's not necessarily just in the Torah, but it says, it speaks about a cursed person who goes and trespasses on the borders which the ancestors created.
Mm-hmm.
And crossing borders was something very, very, actually something quite widely spread inside the ancient world, that you're not allowed to cross anyone's inheritance, you're not allowed to cross beyond their border. And they even discovered these border stones that have curses. Anyone who trespasses beyond this border, tries to do whatever, it will be cursed, etc. And it was always done with invocation of the name of the god.
Mm-hmm.
And this is why, for example, everything that was done when they entered the land, they had to do as a covenant in front of God.
Right.
Because that's part of it. You know, you receive your inheritance, but you have to be aware of what's going to happen. And
sure.
This is why it's also written in the Torah. So the Torah is like a document with a whole bunch of stuff in it.
Mm-hmm.
It's just not laws and stuff like things like that. There's a lot of information of the ancient world coming out through there. And this is why, for example, when they went to the land, they had to say the curses and the blessings near basically what was the center at the time, which is kind of interesting how the center shifts. Because what they did here also was that they moved the tabernacle to Shiloh. And that's where they did everything. You would think, okay, Nablus is, you know, Shechem is in the middle of everything. It's the mist. It's a very, very important area.
Mm-hmm.
But they decided to put the tabernacle, basically say the center of religion, at a different site.
Mm-hmm.
Now, it could be that Shechem was the administrative center for a while, and it was for centuries. It was one of the most important cities before Jerusalem. It was one of the most important cities. It was actually the center, and you actually see when we talk about the Book of Kings, we see that the son of King Solomon's son, Rehavam, actually goes to receive the kingship in Shechem, not in Jerusalem. He's crowned in Jerusalem, yes, but he has to go to Shechem to become king. So it was a center for a very, very long time. This is why, for example, Jacob goes to Shechem. It's not because this, oh, by chance. No, it's literally like a heart. If you ever notice how the roads work in this area, there's a road stretching from Shechem all the way down to the south, and it stretches all the way to the north, and it stretches to the west, and stretches to the east. It's like as if it's an epicenter of everything. Mm-hmm. And it's one of the most ancient cities in this area as well. But they decided to move it to Shiloh. Now, I actually personally have been in Shiloh. There's actually I actually went there with Keith Johnson a while back. Mm-hmm. We were making this video, which hopefully will come out soon. I really hope it does.
Yeah, we're waiting for
because
that.
We worked on the video, and he interviewed a whole bunch of people. And really, I mean, when he told me the names of people he interviewed, I was like, wow, he actually got through these people. And we went to Shiloh, and we spoke about the site, and we went to what was presumably the site of the tabernacle, which is fascinating. Now you go in there, and there's this like area that's marked, literally a square area with like what's remains of walls, and you can see it's the size of basically the courtyard of the tabernacle. And I went through this. There's actually a video I took. Mm-hmm. And I think I figured out where things were there, and there was an interesting marking there, because if you remember when I went to Mount Gerizim, yes. And I yep. noticed something very interesting. I knew of it, I never saw it with my own eyes, but when you go into when you climb on the altar, which apparently I wasn't supposed to do, and
you climbed up on the altar?
I climbed up. The thing is, it's not used anymore. So I had a debate with myself, can you climb on this altar or not? It's been buried. The usage has been stopped. Maybe it's not holy anymore. Also, specifically, because Jerusalem was chosen, then the holiness from any other site has been removed, and everything is now in Jerusalem. Mm-hmm. So I said, okay, I will climb on the altar anyhow, and I walked up, and I noticed inside the structure of the altar itself, inside, which is there's actually sections which are empty, which I presumed were probably filled with earth. And when I went to Shiloh, I found the exact same pattern in an area there. And it wasn't as if someone dug there to figure out what's inside, because it was built the same way. Uh-huh. So I think I actually discovered the side of the altar. The problem was I wasn't too sure exactly what side would be where the ark itself sat. And
right.
In the end, I decided because there were like different things on the ground there which could mark either this way or this way. But it was obvious it was set from east to west, like the temple was. So there is something to the east and west thing. But this way, in the end, I assume that it's probably on the western side of this platform there. But they go, then they do a lot. Now, how exactly that is a very, very good question. They might have used the Urim and Tumim, the breastplate by the mm-hmm. high priest, mm-hmm. Which is a whole subject by itself. There were different theories about it, because it says that Moses placed the Urim and Tumim inside the Choshen, inside the breastplate. And some people want to say it's these are two rocks that one of them says yes and one of them means no, and they put their hand in and pull one of them out. That's a scholarly theory, but we usually explain that the Urim and Tumim are actually the rocks themselves on the breastplate, and the understanding was that he asked a question and certain letters would glow. But we have other examples inside the Bible of someone casting lots, and it's not 100% clear exactly how they did it. There's one opinion that says that, you know, they had, as if for some reason what we do today, they had a hat, and inside there were notes, and each person would go and pull out a note, and then they receive a number, and that number is basically the idea of what they did.
To relate it to something that we would be familiar with today, it'd be like drawing straws, or it'd be like throwing a dice, right? Is that fair enough?
I would say that they did more like the style of maybe a hat. Mm-hmm. I don't think that this the Urim and Tumim were actually involved in this. I think that the whole idea was that because it was done before God, basically at the tabernacle, mm-hmm. and they understood that it's divinely ordained, and therefore whatever decision is made, how to divide the land, God is really the one who
had a hand in the result. So
yeah, there's actually an interesting verse in Proverbs that mentions this idea. Called something. Actually, I want to try to find that verse. Mm-hmm. Let me see if I can actually find it, because it's an interesting verse.
While you're looking for it, Yoel, if hypothetically, I mean, obviously they weren't throwing dice, but if they were throwing dice, they're there in Shiloh before Yehovah at the door of the tabernacle, and they're either drawing straws or they're throwing dice, or they're doing whatever they're doing with it, drawing something out of the hat or whatever it might be. Like in the same way that, you know, you and I, we might flip a coin to make a decision. It's that kind of thing. Only what you're saying is that God himself has a hand in which side the coin lands, right?
Basically, if it's done before God. But we find it's kind of interesting that we also find a lottery or something like that. With Jonah, they do something very similar as well. They're trying to figure out. So maybe they did the short stroll there as well. Uh-huh. So there was an understanding in the ancient world. I'm actually having trouble finding this verse for some reason, the search engine here. Ah, okay, here it is. Proverbs 16, verse 33.
Yes, got it.
Okay, and it says that from the chek, which is basically the inner part of the arm, more close to the body, mm-hmm. the goral, the lot will be cast. But from God is all its rulings.
Yeah, that's what I've got. Okay, in my translation, it says the lot is cast into the lap, but its every decision is from the Lord.
Exactly. So we see that there was an understanding in the ancient world that lot casting is actually divine. And it's kind of interesting because, for example, we also have in the first lot casting we have in Torah, when it comes to temple services during Yom Kippurim, mm-hmm. they cast a lot on which animal will go where. So you see that lot casting is something well known. Mm-hmm. I was actually asked a while back, are we allowed to do this in regular everyday life?
Because that's the question on everyone's mind at the moment. They're going, Joshua, what's Joshua? Are we allowed to enter the lottery? Can we ask Yehovah? Can we ask the Lord as we're filling out our lottery ticket which numbers to tick? Is that what you're telling us?
Not exactly, because these are two very distinct types of lotteries. One's for decision making, the other one is trying to win something.
Sure.
I don't think there's anything wrong with filling out the lottery. Mm-hmm. I've never noticed anything that would say it's forbidden. But for example, I was actually asked by someone not long ago, are we allowed to cast lotteries, lots to make a decision? Mm-hmm. And my response was, I'm not too sure. This might be some kind of a guessing type of thing. But on the other hand, when the Torah speaks about lote nachashu, it's talking about type of guesswork kind of thing, seeing certain clouds in the sky or seeing something happening in front of you. Mm-hmm. But on the other hand, there was a form of witchcraft where they would cast these bones and then read from it. So it's very iffy. This is why when we look in the Bible, except for very specific stories, we see that most of these lots were made in front of God, basically with a priest there, and it was something for divine reasons. Mm-hmm. I'm not too sure about the case, for example, with Saul and Jonathan when they tried to make a decision. But on the other hand, it was related to an oath that was taken before God. So it's still God related, but on the other hand, they might have been using this in an everyday life decision, flip a coin. So again, it's not clear to me. I personally won't do it. I personally don't do it. Mm-hmm. But when I was a kid, it was very popular amongst kids in our school to, for example, open up a Bible and find a verse. And I remember the rabbi telling us not to do that.
Right.
So I don't know. Sure. I personally stopped doing that years and years and years ago.
It's interesting though, isn't it? I mean, if we go back to Joshua chapter 7, and we spoke about this already, but there is the whole singling out of Achan, who mm-hmm. sinned by burying the goodies under his tent. Would that have been done by Lot?
So there, it doesn't really give a lot of information. It just says that they somehow realized it was this tribe, and then suddenly realized it was this family from the tribe, mm-hmm. and then they realized it was this family inside the family. But it doesn't give us details exactly how it was done. But there are places where there are hints that priests were involved, and they were carrying an ephod. Basically, they were carrying a breastplate with the straps that connect with the thing that goes from the back. Mm-hmm. And that might have been the way they did it. There must have been some kind of glowing so they could know what's going on. Okay. That's some kind of marker told them. In the rabbinical tradition, it says that the letters would glow and the priest would be able to read what it actually says.
Our God can do anything, and if he's going to speak with mm-hmm. us directly, and if that's the way that he chooses, then sure, it can certainly happen. It may have happened that way.
Yeah, so this is basically what I can, quote unquote, call the biblical oracle of sorts.
Yes, that's a good way to put it. And so there they
different.
Are.
This is not some intoxicated virgin that speaks and tells you things or whatever it is.
It's a sound
down to earth
in the Greek temples.
Yeah, it's a sound mm-hmm. down to earth group of people that live their regular lives. There's no mysticism or anything mm-hmm. in this.
Amen. So they divided the inheritance by lot in Shiloh before the Lord at the door of the tabernacle of meetings. So they made an end of dividing the country, is what it says in verse 51. So now we're knocking on the door of the city of refuge.
We're knocking on the door of the city of refuge. So this is actually a fulfillment mentioned in the book of Exodus, and then mentioned also in the book of Deuteronomy. And it's an interesting, it's basically the only type of prison we find in the Bible. The Bible does not believe in the concept of prison. Mm-hmm. The Bible believes in the concept of whatever was done should be retaliated at that person. Now, I'm not going to go into the whole discussion about an eye for an eye, tooth for a tooth. In simplicity, it's probably taken literal. But again, it's not my job here to clarify that here at the moment, because it's been an issue of debate inside the Jewish world for many, many centuries, basically from the Second Temple period. But we do see in the Bible the concept of retaliation on the same pattern. I actually have here at home an entire book that goes over all the cases of an eye for an eye, tooth for tooth, basically the idea. I can't forget what there's a term for it. Mm-hmm. There's an actual term for the specific retaliation, which I don't remember now. But you see that whatever was done is done upon that person. For example, we see in the book of Ovadiah, "Kasher asita yaaseh lach gimulcha yashuv b'roshecha." As you have done, it will be done to you as well. Your reward will come upon your head. It talks about the house of Edom, because the Edomites were actually involved in the war against Judea in this first temple period. And some people claim they were also involved in the second temple period, to a point where someone blamed the Edomites for burning the temple. And in the first temple period, because these prophecies are from the first temple period, it says there that the house of Edom, and we see this in several places, the Edomites were always competing against Israel, and they claim that they were heavily involved in the destruction of Judea. So God basically says, you put Judea into ruins, I will put you into ruins as retaliation. Mm-hmm. So we see that that exists. But on the other hand, what do you do with cases of where there's no intention of harming someone, it was done by mistake?
Right. So, and it's not as if, I mean, when you read this chapter 20, you think, well, this is happening all the time. But when we think about, our society today, these things happen, right? And they don't happen every day, but they do. You hear about how there was someone accidentally hit somebody else when they were driving the car and they didn't see them and it was unintentional, or they came out in front of them and they didn't expect it, or whatever it may be. These things do happen, and they obviously happened back then as well. And it's interesting that you make reference to it as a prison. It would be fairer to say that it was a kind of a house arrest.
It was a kind of a house, because it wasn't as if they were locked down into something. Mm. There were prisons, either called Beit HaSor or Beit HaKele or Beit HaKalu. But what we see in the Bible is the Bible doesn't really believe in prisons. The Bible basically says, okay, if you do something deliberately, what you have done will be given back to you. We see that with knife for knife and tooth for tooth.
Yes.
That I personally believe that is only when it's done deliberately. Because, for example, it says that if two people go into a fight and one of them gets injured, then there's different things. For example, if he kills the person, it's inside a fight, and the Torah says, oh, your intention was to murder, so you are to be executed. For example, if someone is injured, all what you do is you take care of them. You pay them, you pay money for their healing, and you pay money for what they lose. Basically, the fact that they had to rest.
And so
we also find...
Sorry, I was just going
to
say...
Wait, there's different examples here.
Yeah.
Now, for example, we also have the case of false witnesses. Whatever the false witnesses wanted to be done to that person, they will receive that, either financial, in slavery, whatever it is, they receive that, even execution, they receive whatever they wanted to testify about that person. So we see that it's always you do something, you get something back. Mm-hmm. Now, when it comes to accidental cases, here, what do you do if you accidentally kill someone?
And that's the question, because maybe you can tell me where this is, but I think it's in Exodus where there's God gives a hypothetical, and that happens a lot. He gives us he says, if this happens and it happens like this, and if this happens and so on and so forth, and then he says, then you'll do such and such. And in this case, like, if I remember correctly, if, for example, you're in the forest and you're chopping down a tree and you've got your axe and you swing back your axe and the head of the axe comes off and it flies back and it hits your neighbor and kills him, you've killed him unintentionally. Whereabouts is that again?
Either here in Numbers or in Deuteronomy 19. Let's look at that for a second.
All right.
Deuteronomy 19. Yeah, it's a Deuteronomy 19, verse 5.
Oh, truly.
If a person goes in, it's verse 5, yeah. It's Deuteronomy verse 5.
Chapter 5 or?
19 verse 5.
Sorry. All right. So this is the example that pops in my head. I'll read it out here. I have it. As when a man goes into the woods, yes, this is the one. As with a man goes into the woods with his neighbor to cut timber, and his hand swings a stroke with the axe to cut down a tree, and the head slips from the handle and strikes his neighbor so that he dies. He shall flee to one of these cities and live.
Exactly. Now, the thing is, you have to remember, this person committed what we can call manslaughter, and actually the family has the right to retaliate for this manslaughter. And if this person's killed on the way, or if they leave after the refuge, because this doesn't happen just, I'm going to run to a city, I've killed someone. It doesn't really work like that. You go to the city, because the description works like this. You go to the city and he goes to the elders, and he tells, I by mistake killed someone. So they protect him from the family. The family obviously figures out where this person is. Now, if this person committed intentional murder, then, because he only uses the word murderer, it doesn't use manslaughter or anything, or hereg, it says rotzech. Mm-hmm. It actually says, you are still a murderer. And what probably happened was the person would go to the elders, say, I by mistake killed someone. The family probably figure out where this person is, go to the city, and if they have any witnesses that this was actual murder, they bring the witnesses. And the moment the witnesses are found as true witnesses, then the person has to be executed, probably by the family.
Mm-hmm.
So it's not as if someone can just run to it and be saved.
Now,
actually a trial.
What if he's actually pursued before he arrives at his destination of the city of refuge? I mean,
if he's killed, he's dead. That's it. And they can't do anything to the family.
And they're allowed to do that, right? But I mean, I'm looking at verse 5 of chapter 20 in Joshua. Then if the avenger of blood pursues him, they shall not deliver the slayer into his hand because he struck his neighbor unintentionally, but did not hate him beforehand. So there's a qualification, mm-hmm. right? If he was struck because he hated him, then you see a premeditated murder.
Mm-hmm.
But
mm-hmm.
if it was unintentional because he did not hate him beforehand, then
for example, if I have a feud with one of my neighbors and I by mistake drop something out my window, lands on the person's head and he gets killed, you can't just use the argument of but they were fighting.
Sure,
it's not enough. You have to actually prove that this was deliberate.
Good point.
And again, you also have to remember, what do you do in a case where you're protecting yourself
mm-hmm.
and you killed the person who tries to kill? Sure. The family's going to run out, say bloody murder, and say, he murdered him. No, it's not exactly like that.
Self-defense.
This was out of self-defense. But the Bible does talk about what is done in certain situations. For example, if you're fighting and you pick up a club and hit the guy in the head and kill him, you can't really scream out self-defense. You have to be very, very careful what you do.
Mm.
But in general, there's a few details of questions here we have to ask, because the Bible just gives several examples. What happens if the person go in a fire and he smacks him with something which can kill, with an even yado begrof, the guy gets killed in the fight. There must be some kind of logic here. He runs at you with a sword and wants mm-hmm. to kill you, and you protect yourself when you kill the person. You can't run around and say this was murder. This was self-defense. So there has to be some kind of a balance here, and this is why there's a court. So, for example, they go in there, so the witness says, yes, he struck him down with a sword. And the guy says, I have my own witnesses, and the witnesses walk in and say this was a fight, and the deceased tried to kill this guy with a sword as well. And then the elders have to say, okay, well, self-defense.
So it's a
different case.
Nehemiah was telling me that maybe you can clarify this. I don't quite remember. But if someone breaks into your house and you shoot him, you've got a gun and you shoot him because he's broken into your house with the intent of stealing and possibly doing you harm, is that, are you in the clear? Because I know in some countries that's fair game, right? But in Israel, what's the situation there?
First of all, in the Bible, it's fair game. If someone breaks into your house at nighttime and you kill them, the law is that you're allowed to. Now, here in Israel, it's a very, very good question. I'm not too sure exactly what the Israeli law is. And even if there's an Israeli law, it doesn't really mean that it's applied in the way where we might read it outside the law books.
Mm-hmm.
But there was a case several years ago of a farmer who shot and killed someone who broke into his farm. And they said that what he did was completely legal, that these people, they also spoke about the fact that these people, I think they were Arabs,
mm-hmm.
and they trespassed into Jewish property. And when Arabs break into a house, there's always a danger of something happening. Unfortunately, we're having cases here in Israel with, for example, rape victims by Arabs or Sudanese or refugees who come to Israel, and they break into houses and they do horrendous things sometimes. There's a whole bunch of stuff been going on lately. Some of it, a large percentage of it, actually is coming from Arabs and illegal immigrants to Israel. And the question will be, what will happen at one point if someone actually kills one of them?
And I'm
wondering what the Israeli law will do with such a situation.
Mm-hmm.
But essentially,
it's probably bound to happen, I would think.
It might happen. People, for example, in South Tel Aviv now are suffering from these illegal immigrants. And these people are completely legal. There's no people just came in to work. They've been infiltrating into Israel, and it's just there's so many of them. There's a big mess here going on here in Israel about it. Mm. But the notion is that they're probably going to be deported very, very soon. All the human rights groups are saying, oh, don't do it. It's not humane. La, di, la, di, la. And I'm saying something very, very simple. You know, I understand that, but we can't be the dumpster of the Middle East. We have enough Arabs here, for example, who didn't originate from this area. You know, there's a limit of how humane you can be about certain things. So, you know, when the Jews wanted to run away from Nazi Germany, they were rejected by different countries, mm-hmm. specifically the United States and England. Mm-hmm. And that's called hypocrisy. Serious, it's hypocrisy. These people come in here, they cause a lot of damage. They're disrupting life in certain areas. One of them raped a woman 2 weeks ago. He was caught, but there was a rape case. They're very violent towards people. It's been documented. They go into, they take over neighborhoods, mm-hmm. and they're violent.
Let me ask you a question, Yoel. Let's take this rape case. Somebody breaks in to her house, let's say at night. She pulls out a gun or a sword, if it was back in the day, and she strikes him through. She kills him. Now, he's broken into her house at night. Is she required to run to a city of refuge?
No.
Okay.
No, because this is not the case the Torah speaks about. Mm-hmm. Torah says, if someone breaks into your house and you kill them, that's it. Damam be'rosham, their blood is in their head. They're endangering themselves.
Mm-hmm. Amen.
So when you break into someone's house, I don't know what your plan is, but my point is to protect my family. End of mm-hmm. story.
Right. So what we're talking about, totally unintentional mishaps, and an accident. In fact, that's what it says. It has both, at least in the English here in verse 3, that the slayer who kills a person accidentally or unintentionally. I mean, what is the difference in those two words? What do you have in verse 3? What are the Hebrew words there?
Let me go back there again.
I've got accidentally or unintentionally.
You're reading Deuteronomy, right?
No, we're still in Joshua chapter 20, verse 3. Sorry.
Man, you're skipping from book to book. Again, where are we? This is the one thing. Josh. Have you noticed? I didn't notice the fact that you do this to me all the time.
It's because, you know, I've got all these fingers in all these different books.
yeah, well, get your fingers out of the books. Where are we?
Okay, chapter 20, verse 3, it says that the slayer who kills a person accidentally or unintentionally may flee there, and they shall be your refuge from the avenger of blood. Yes. So accidentally or unintentionally, there's two words that I would have said mean the same thing. Is there two different Hebrew words, and what's the difference in the meaning?
So it uses the word shgaga, which basically means it means a mistake or an error.
Mm-hmm.
And vlidat is without knowledge, without intention. So it's referring to two things. It's referring to one's intention, and it's referring to one's something done by mistake.
So for example, if I'm intentionally wanting to kill someone for whatever that reason might be, whether it's justified or not, and I pull the trigger and lo and behold, it turns out to be someone else, I've killed that person in error. I can run to the city of refuge.
You're still a murderer.
Oh, okay. Okay, so what does it
because
mean?
Because your intention was to kill. Mm. So bishgaga means, for example, I don't know, maybe these things have to be in the case. It was done by mistake and unintentionally.
Because,
mm-hmm. for example, if I shoot, as you said, if I shoot someone and by mistake kill someone else, but my intention was to kill, that we still have the intention of the murder here. Sure. So this was deliberate murder, but unintention. There was the intention of murder, but it was done by mistake.
Mm-hmm.
Or you can have the case of, you can have a case, for example, that you were not intending to kill anyone, but it was done by mistake. This is why these words are deliberately picked, mm-hmm. because really, you know, it's never black and white. Let me explain something very, very important here about the issue of how to decide things in the law. Nothing is black and white, and specifically in these cases, you know. How you decide if you're allowed to do a certain type of work during Shabbat or you're not allowed to do, is this a kosher animal? These are relatively black and white cases. But when you're dealing with human beings and human behavior and human error, whatever it is, there's always different details. There's always that we have to figure out exactly what happened.
What the intention was.
And this
was.
Is why, what the intention was, and you have to, you know, you have to bring witnesses and everything. It's not like, he murdered, okay, execute. It doesn't work like that. This is not, you know, Judea of the first century Judea, where the Romans is, oh, we don't like him, okay, let's execute him. You know, it's not the same thing. Mm. Here, there has to be a trial, and they have to bring witnesses. And if there are no witnesses, you can't claim anything. And you have to check exactly what happened. Well, are there enemies? No, they're not enemies. What exactly happened? They bring witnesses to check. Mm-hmm. It's never black and white. It's never like bang, bang, we're done.
Sure.
Okay. There's always a trial here. So any feud, any decision that has to be made in between people is always a lot more complex. This is why things in between people are never decided individual. I decided something, you know, I'm allowed to do something to XYZ. You know, he stole from me, therefore I'm going to go and retaliate for it. You're not supposed to do that. You can decide whatever you want. You can think you're right about the situation. But when you actually go in front of someone else and go for a trial, there's like details you don't realize or something that's blinded you from seeing the correct details of what happened. So
there it is.
This is why it's using such language where there's different details you have to pay attention to.
Sure. And so the cities are listed there in verse 7 of chapter 20, verse 7, verse 8. And these are the cities appointed for all the children of Israel and for the stranger who dwelt among them, that whoever killed the person accidentally might flee there and not die by the hand of the avenger of blood until he stood before the congregation. And that's what you're talking about, until he stands before them and there's the witnesses and so on and so forth. And now we're in chapter 21. Now this is a bit of you, right? This is the cities of the Levites. Do you want to take us through it?
I'm not sure it has to do with me specifically, but yes, it has to do with the Levites. And the whole idea was as follows. The Levites, because the Levites, the inheritance of the Levites is actually receiving under, basically because of their service at the temple, receiving, instead of receiving portions from the land, the Levites received portions of the produce of the land. And there's a big question also, you know, what do you do today with Levites? Are they really in service or not? What exactly is service? You know, there's a whole question there. Actually, maybe you should post again the whole thing about lesson we did on tithing.
We talked about
Essentially, first of all, when we say Levite, we're not saying Cohen. We're saying a Levite. Mm-hmm. And there's a difference in between the two groups. I've actually received emails from people, can you redeem my firstborn? And the answer is no. Why? Because I am a Levite, not a Cohen.
Mm-hmm.
Now, when it comes to Kohanim, what they received is actually portions from the temple, from what was given as sacrifices and first fruits and stuff like that. Mm-hmm. Also, the priests, the Kohanim, were a smaller group. So you can't give such a small group all the produce from the land. So to be entitled to receive a tithe, the person has to be a Levite. Now, I want to say something here, and I might be stepping on someone's toes, but I have to say it. Levites are genetic descendants of the house of Levi.
Mm-hmm.
You can't say someone is a Levite and they're not genetically descended from the house of Levi.
Mm-hmm.
What can exist is, for example, there is such a concept of elders and teachers and stuff like that, which received from people gifts because of their position, because they have to be all involved all the time with work with the community, answering questions, sitting as a judge, stuff like that. So they were busy. They didn't have time to work. So these people take their lives and become teachers and stuff like that. Levites, on the other hand, the job of the Levites is to keep the Torah and make sure it's known in the nation. Mm-hmm. So a full functional Levite will be a person who teaches Torah, who tries to help, stuff like that, but he's also a genetic descendant of the house of Levi. Now, because the Levites were the ones in charge of the Torah, the ones who actually had the Torah scrolls, they were in charge of teaching. And this is why they had to be scattered amongst the people. Now, you can't just, you know, tell them, oh, you're going to live wherever and find a house to live. No, to make sure that Levites have somewhere to live, there were 48 designated cities, which were each tribe had to give the city, and each tribe gave in between something like 5 to 10, maybe. It variates there inside the text, depending also on the size of the inheritance they had. And the Levites were basically spread all over the country because the Levites don't have to be at the temple. And the because there's no land, Levites receive the tithe. Now, when the cities were built, or taken over, all they received was like a small area around it, what's called a migrash, which was very, very, very small. But it was like a piece of land around it so they can, for example, build, I don't know, barns, for example, something like that, or places of storage, or even if they had animals, they could store their animals there. People didn't usually store their animals inside the city. It stank.
Sure.
But that's all the land they received. So there was no agriculture amongst the Levites.
Right.
The priests, on the other hand, received, there was like a 9 cities as well that they received because they became hundreds of people as well. So in the temple itself, in the tabernacle itself, the only real all the time functioning priests were only the family of the high priest and maybe priests that came over every once in a while for service. It was only the times of King David where they kind of like established the house of the Kohanim, of the priests, as groups that came at very, very specific times. Now, besides this, there are also part of the refuge cities were also Hebron, for example, was a Levite city, but was also a city of refuge. And I don't know if there's anything else I can detail about this. Basically, it was just giving places to live to enable the Levites to have somewhere to live because they didn't have land of their own. They could just, oh, I want that hill. I'm going to sit on that hill and build a house. We can't really do that. Mm-hmm. But one of the things we do find is that probably what Levites did was it might have been people were traveling around the country as well, and they might have been the cities were placed in strategic places where if anyone had any questions or anything that was disputed in the gates before the time of the temple being built, because it says that when there's a dispute, then you go to the place that God chose, or God will choose in the text there. Mm-hmm. So they might have gone to the Levites as the final authority in the beginning. And then when the elders sat in Jerusalem, first of all, they said the Sanhedrin was mostly composed of Levites and priests, and the regular Israelites weren't too many regular Israelites on the court there. So really you see that Levites have several functions here, Levites and priests. Today the priests don't have any real function. They don't really do anything besides doing a priestly blessing and receiving the redemption of the firstborn. But they're also highly respected. I mean, if you're a Kohen, a Kohanim are highly respected, but they don't. Most Kohanim I know don't use it. They don't say, I'm a Kohen, respect me. They don't do that. But what they probably did was, you know, being judges, being teachers of Torah, being responsible for the spiritual awareness of the people. Mm-hmm. The Kohanim basically were service in the temple. They were in charge of a lot of spiritual things, for example, leprosy and anything that had ritual things that were related to the temple. So leprosy, the beheading if we're talking about murders, so you have cases if someone's found slain and on the road, so they go to the near city and they bring the elders of that near city and then they take a calf and they chop its head off to find redemption or, you know, atone for the murder because they don't know who did it. Mm-hmm. And if they actually says that if they discover who murdered the person, then they have to execute that person. Stuff like that. They're involved in things like that. But the Levites were involved probably in the everyday life things,
right?
Because they also probably the majorities that were more of Levites. So probably were the only some of the only people who were able to read and write. They're probably also the only people who actually had Torah scrolls, and they probably held the knowledge and the correct interpretation of things.
Now, somewhere in the book of Ezekiel, in the latter chapters of Ezekiel, it also talks about. I mean, when the temple is reinstituted or the sacrificial system is set up again. And it talks, correct me if I'm wrong, but doesn't it talk about an area of land for the Levites in there, right?
So it's interesting. There's like as if, okay, now that, you know, probably it's instead of the 48 cities. Now, we're also talking about a time where we no longer needed, you know, they won't have to have the Israelites, the Levites scattered amongst everyone because they all know, everyone will know who God is and everyone will know what has to be done. Mm-hmm. But it's also, when you look at it there, it's very administrative. It's like, you know, we have the area of the temple, the area for the priests, the area for the Levites. Mm-hmm. It doesn't mean that there's agriculture. There is agriculture. Actually, there is agriculture in the description there for the temple. And anyone who had to be in temple service, meaning farmers, herdsmen, you know, stuff like that, lived in the proximity of the temple and in the city itself and had the lands around it. Mm-hmm. And the Levites received some area to live in. But because we're talking also about a time where, you know, we're describing it's a perfect utopia, then there's no need for the Levites to be scattered because everyone's going to know where the Torah is. And the Levites are just going to have a service position, but probably also to teach and stuff like that. But they don't have to be scattered. There's no need anymore to have strongholds of Torah amongst the people, because it's not going to be as problematic as it was. It won't be any danger of abandoning the Torah.
At that time,
and I think also at this time, it still functions like this, that they're not supposed to be, you know, people are abandoning Torah, and there has to be people out there preaching and teaching. So, it's really the job of the Levites, not just, if a person decides from his own to go out and he's going to be preaching and teaching and everything, then fine, there's nothing wrong with that. But that person doesn't replace the Levites.
Amen. He certainly does not.
That person may not dare even claim themselves as being Levites. That's a Christian concept that's infiltrated into the Messianic world. Mm-hmm. And these people are not Levites.
Amen.
But again, as I said when I spoke about the issue of tithe, if these people put effort into teaching people and making sure that people have the knowledge of the Torah, not, you know, give you a feel-good preaching, but knowledge of the Torah, then you can give that person a gift, but it's not tithe.
But it's not tithe.
And I'm actually putting my foot down here because I've heard many, many times from people, oh, he's calling himself a Levite, such and such. Mm-hmm. No one specific. Mm-hmm. But I keep on hearing, you know, the order of Melchizedek and stuff like that. Mm-hmm. You know, I don't know about the older Melchizedek. I know about the descendants of the house of Aaron. Amen. And the descendants of the house of Levi. That's what I know from the Torah.
Amen. Amen. And actually, now before we jump off that topic, you and I were talking about this just recently, and we did cite Ezra chapter 2, where it talks about how there were men who returned. And verse 62, they sought their listing among those who were registered by genealogy, but they were not bound. Therefore, they were exiled from the priesthood as defiled. And the governor said to them that they should not eat of the most holy things until a priest could consult with the Urim and the Thummim. And so there it is. That's what we're waiting for. There are a lot of people who think that maybe based on, you know, we were talking about DNA, right? And DNA testing.
Remember that.
Like that. And, based on certain pointers, does this mean that I'm a Levite? I'm going to declare to everyone that I'm a Levite now. I'm going to tell everyone that they can give to me because I'm a Levite. Blah, 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 blah. But really, it's not until we have a high priest again that can determine these things.
Exactly. So we have people. So the question here specifically, these were people who did not know their genealogies. Mm-hmm. I, for example, know my genealogy. I know a lot of people that know their genealogy. Yeah. No one can date back their genealogy like to the time of the Second Temple or the First Temple. No one has that. But I, for example, can trace back my genealogy for at least 200-300 years backwards. Mm-hmm. I think that's enough, you know.
Sure.
And I know I actually did meet once a family that claimed they had a scroll that dated back all the way into the Second Temple period. But they claim the scroll was lost. And I hear this story a lot. I mean, we had a scroll, it was lost. We had this, it was lost. I don't know about that. But the one thing I do know that there are many families that have genealogies and family traditions of their Levites. And that's the only real thing the Bible recognizes.
Mm-hmm.
So what do you do with DNA now is a very, very good question. I think it's interesting. I think a person that has that should research into his family tree.
Yes.
And see exactly who, where, what, and how.
Yes.
But not run out and say, oh, I'm a Cohen, I'm a Levite, you know.
Yes.
We don't even know if you're Jewish.
It's a dangerous thing, right? It's a dangerous thing. But it certainly don't exclude that evidence.
Yeah, but we're not excluded that. I mean, if you have a marker, you should go and check your family tree. You should check what goes in. Start digging. You'll put the effort in and start digging.
Yeah.
But the danger in this, I want to really say something, and I'm saying this full-hearted without any hatred, but I'm saying people who go out there, for example, and claim they're Levites and to say, oh, we're Levites, we should receive a tithe, whatever, besides being, in many cases, a lie, do you have any idea who you're messing with?
Yeah,
read Malachi. Read the book of Malachi.
Mm.
You're gonna play around with that. You're playing around with God. You're messing with God's covenant. Mm. What do you think you're doing?
That's right.
And I'm saying this as a word of warning. You know, if you're a liar and your point is having an industry and you want to make money off of this industry, so that's your issue. You know, when God decides to do something about you, he'll do it.
That's right. And the Torah is full of examples of men who have assumed to step into God-given positions that they should not be in, and yet they claim to be they put themselves in those positions. They claim to be in those positions, and then God deals with them very severely. And we find numerous examples of that throughout the Torah.
Mm-hmm. Exactly. Anyhow. So, again, this is not of hatred or anything, but it says that God's Torah is perfect, and it, and it's truth and stuff, and basically everything. For example, Book of Psalms writes about it, and you know we have to be. You know, if we're trying to really follow Torah, we have to try to be as exact as we can.
Amen.
And this subject comes up a lot because because I'm a Levite. People ask me this question all the time. Because I'm presumably an authority on the subject, but I'm not. But the point is that if you really want, as I point out again, I'm repeating what I said, and I think what we spoke about the tithing issue. If this person's a teacher and he puts effort into teaching and he tries to teach as much as he can, he's being truthful about it. There is a very, very strong inclination in the Bible that this person is a teacher of truth. And you should give to them whatever you feel that you should give, but don't presume that's the tithe of the Torah.
Amen.
And the whole thing of the older Melchizedek is highly questionable.
And we've spoken about that before too. What I'm going to do is put a link to the tithing conversation that you and I had on this post. But I'm going to begin to wrap this up, Yoel, and I'm going to read from verse 41 of Joshua 21. To the end of the chapter, is that okay?
Yeah.
It says, all the cities of the Levites within the possession of the children of Israel were 48 cities with their common lands. Every one of these cities had its common land surrounding it. Thus were all the cities. Verse 43, so Yehovah gave to Israel and a land of which he had sworn to give to their fathers, and they took possession of it and dwelt in it. The Lord gave them rest all around according to that he had sworn to give their fathers, and not a man of all the enemies stood against them. And the Lord delivered all their enemies into their hand. Not a word failed, I love this verse, not a word failed of any good thing which Yehovah had spoken to the house of Israel, all came to pass. Is that not an awesome verse?
It's an awesome verse, but there's actually a problem with it because, yes, actually God did fulfill everything that he promised, but they didn't conquer the entire land. We actually find that are on these pockets of Canaanites, which were causing a lot of trouble. So when I read this verse, I go like, yeah, but, you know, yeah, he did do miracles, he did do this, and everything actually did happen, but they never really fully conquered the land. I always have to debate with myself what exactly is going on here.
Right.
But he actually did give their enemy all the enemies to their hand in their hand, and he did everything. But you kind of realize, because we're about to finish the book of Joshua, and we're going to go into the book of Judges, and we learn something about the covenant here, and we'll talk about it when we go to the book of Judges. But basically what it's telling us here is that God did everything from his end.
Mm-hmm.
We didn't really do everything from our end.
Right.
And that's where the book of Judges come into picture. We have to finish the book of Joshua before that.
And so we're going to be getting into, and boy, doesn't the book of Judges bring that to life, but we're going to be getting into next time into chapter 22. And so thank you, Yoel Ben Shlomo. His Facebook page is Hebrew in Israel. And if you would like Hebrew lessons from this very knowledgeable man, you can inquire by emailing at hebrewinisrael@gmail.com. hebrewinisrael@gmail.com. And if these programs have been a blessing to you, you can also show your support by donating at truth2u.org. That's truth number two, letter u.org. But it's not a tithe, is it?
It's not a tithe.
You're not tithing. So, my friend, thank you once again for being on Truth to You. Next week, we're going to be kicking off from chapter 22. And until then, dear listeners, be blessed and be set apart by the truth of our Father's word. Shalom.
Shalom, kol tov.